Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
80 minutes in now, and we've got a bunch of fortunately Steve has survived his gunplay, and right. we're happy about that.
The ears are still ringing.
Yes, like so much vibranium shielding. Let's get into this. What's going on in minute 80, Hal?
Peggy Carter strides out of the London laboratory, leaving Steve Rogers and Howard Stark staring after her, stunned by her casual gunfire. Steve, recovering, hands Stark a piece of notepad paper, his sketch of a uniform design. I had some ideas about the uniform. Howard, still dazed, says, "Whatever you want, pal." A montage unfolds. Steve, now Captain America, prepares for battle. He holsters a shotgun on his motorcycle, loads a pistol, and slings his new vibranium shield, its iconic star gleaming, over his shoulder. In a swift cut, Captain America and his howling commandos kick open a barn door, weapons blazing as they charge forward. At a Hydra factory, Steve hurls his shield, dropping Hydra soldiers left and right, then plants a satchel charge. As his team retreats, the factory erupts in a massive explosion, Steve speeding away on his motorcycle, flames roaring behind him. At night, the Red Skull halts his car beside the smoldering ruins of the factory, his face twisted with fury. In the Strategic Scientific Reserve headquarters, Army technicians shift flags and model tanks on a tactical map of Europe. A flag is removed and handed to Peggy Carter, marking another Hydra defeat. In snowy woods, shrouded in morning fog, Steve and his commandos creep forward. Steve signals for caution and freezes at a faint sound. He hurls his shield into the tree canopy and a Hydra soldier tumbles to the ground. Steve catches the shield with a deft grab.
What a time. What a great montage to be living in. Hal, our previous episode, you're out on an assignment. So
yes,
I think you had some thoughts. So why don't we give you some time to catch up on 79 as we're leading into minute 80 here.
All right. So just as we transition from minute 79 here into minute 80, you know, our ears are ringing as the from Peggy's gunfire and everybody's reacting to that. It was just what it brought to mind for me was it seems like a few lifetimes ago, I had a brief stint in law enforcement. And at the time, I don't know if all manufacturers did this, but I bought my body armor, colloquially a bulletproof vest. It's really bullet resistant is the proper marketing legal term, from a company called Second Chance Body Armor. And one of the things I always thought was interesting they did was to inspire a little bit of confidence. First of all, the founder of it I'm drawing a blank on his name. I could find it here in just a second, but he would go out to various departments and then shoot himself in the chest with whatever weapon they happened to have just to show how well it worked. And that, boy, don't try that at home because you're still, yeah. There's still a lot of power and a lot of force. But anyway, when you bought armor from them, and I had a Kevlar vest with then a steel shock plate that went in over the breastbone, they included a sample piece of Kevlar, just the lining, the material in it, said, take it out to the range and shoot it, and it'll build confidence in the product. And sure enough, you know, you do that, you tack it up out there and things are making dents, but not, you know, nothing you'd fire at it. I mean, short of maybe, you know, a higher power rifle round or something, certainly nothing in the handgun range would go through it. And I always thought that was, that's an interesting way of what, you know, sort of this grim topic, but it's like now in specially marked packages, sample Kevlar for you to shoot and see how it works. So
wow. It's fascinating. Yeah. So wow. Did the founder survive? Did he make it to retirement?
He did, although the company had kind of a rough time because a few years after I had moved on to another career, they introduced a new line of armor and there was a different kind of fabric, you know, woven fabric that actually, you know, was that secret ingredient. It was something out of Japan. And I don't recall the whole story, but I know it was, you know, it's lighter and better and everything's great. And these things are going to be so much more comfortable. That's even without a 6x12-inch rectangle of steel in it. They were heavy and they were binding and bulky and stuff. So this new fabric was supposed to be great, but then it was found that it really didn't do the job like it was supposed to. Wow. So I don't know that there was any serious incidents, but it just basically came that, first the at the federal government level, they said for, you know, any military personnel that are carrying this, you know, get rid of it and get something else. And then law enforcement agencies followed that. That was a pretty big blow for the company. And I know they were bought out. So I don't think even the brand exists anymore, but they were bought out, and body armor is still a big business for law enforcement.
Fascinating. I love that story. That's great.
Wow.
You paint a nice picture, Hal.
Yeah.
So, we did always talk about, the idea of putting it on we'll put it on a watermelon. That'll be real accurate. And then you think, okay, well, if you walk up to a watermelon, you channel your inner Gallagher, it doesn't matter that nothing's going to penetrate. It's still going to just sploosh out the back. And that's not going to be very confidence building.
Yeah. It's going to transmit the force regardless.
Right.
Yeah.
So, no matter how much it dissipates, watermelon isn't going to hold up the same way that that a human body would.
This particular minute that we're discussing is a great example of the film term. The French always have great film terms, and this one is montage. I love montages. They're part of the history of film, and fortunately, I've managed to dig up my old film school notes on montages. So, if you don't mind a lecture right now, I'd be happy to give you one.
I think that's why we're all here, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Well, pull up a chair and get out your notepads and turn to page 158. The whole idea of film in motion, just rather than watching, pushing a button on a camera and having it spool out a single scene all at once, the ability to edit. And Brian, I'm sure you're familiar with this with comic strips. A sequential group of images will tell a story. Yeah. And this goes back to a British fellow named Robert W. Paul back in 1898. He actually did the first music video, I guess you could call it. There's a British dance hall song called Come Along Do. And he basically illustrated it in 1898 in a film. And he cut one scene after another. There's only pieces of this film that survive. But we see a couple of edits where he talks this woman into going with him to an art gallery. And you see him outside the art gallery, and you see him inside the art gallery. So the audience has to get the idea. Yes, he's gone into the art gallery, and this is the next scene in the little play he's doing. That whole idea of developing one scene after another was really fleshed out by a fellow named Edwin S. Porter, who worked for Thomas Edison. And back in 1903 in West Orange, New Jersey, he came up with the Great Train Robbery, which really popularized the idea of one scene following another. Now, that was an American thing. The British fellow, Robert Paul, came up with editing. Edwin S. Porter came up with the idea of scenes being interchangeable. But it really hit its peak with Lev Kuleshov, who scientifically thought about the Kuleshov effect, where you see one scene, you see another scene, and you try to relate the two in your head. And the further apart those scenes are, if they don't make any sense at all, your brain is trying desperately to stitch them together. It's like, what does that scene have to do with this scene? So he leaned into that and started building shows that that editing effect would pull audiences in. And one of his students or coworkers, depending on how you look at it, was Sergei Eisenstein, who is probably one of the most famous Russian directors and editors. He came up with, there's actually five different methods of building these scenes. There's the metric, which is like a metronome. It's like, here's where you're looking at this scene, then you follow this scene and another scene. And if you build that up along the same time, it becomes rhythmic. So you have a rhythmic series, and we're seeing that here, that there's a rhythm to it. Maybe you see like a 15-second scene and another 15-second scene and another 15-second scene. So that rhythm, your eye gets used to, okay, now we're going to see something new. And they'll all have the same tone. So we're seeing, in this particular minute, we're seeing the the commandos are pushing toward you all the time. They're moving ahead, and Red Skull is being pushed behind. That whole putting groups of these edited scenes together becomes an overtonal scene. It's telling you a story without having to use words. You're getting the whole idea. The commandos are winning. Red Skull and Hydra are losing, and Peggy's on the side cheering them on, and understanding that that she's really falling for Steve over again, and overlooking his little peccadillo with the private and the clerk and at the SSR. There's so many other things that we get used to in films. If you've seen the movie Airport, for example, or the movie Woodstock, there's what they call a triptych, where you have different scenes showing at the same time, and you're allowed to like look at scenes going on at the same time, so you can also stitch those in your head. And you think that's pretty new. You've seen split screen movies and things like that, but really that goes all the way back to a fellow named Abel Gance in France, who came up with Napoleon in 1927 and developed this idea of a split screen, where you're seeing two things going on at once and you're just following along sequentially. Later on, that Russian idea, the what Eisenstein came about with montage, a fellow named Slavko Vorkovich, I hope I'm saying his name right, he's Serbian. He learned from Eisenstein's school and brought that to America. So he became part of the studio things like Manhattan Melodrama, San Francisco, and even Frank Capra movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Those montages that he built in those popular Hollywood movies became part of the American Hollywood studio language of a montage that moves all the way up into what we consider modern day movies like the baptism scene in The Godfather, Coppola using the montage of seeing all of Michael Corleone's enemies getting wiped out while this religious ceremony is going on at the same time. Or and probably the most famous montage of this generation or the previous generation is the Rocky montage, where he's training, and that became almost a kind of a cliche or a stereotype in the Rocky movie. You had to have a training montage with.
The training montage is a trope of its own,
And you'll see that every, and it's, you know, it's been harp, yeah, it's been lampooned in bunches of films and things like that. I mean, you know, even
Or
things like
Harpoon.
Airplane. Yeah, exactly. Or Harpoon, yes.
Harpoon.
So, Hal and I have done a couple of Joe Johnston movies, but really the only montage I can think of in any of his films was this one, and also the Rocket Boys learning how to build rockets in October Sky. So Joe doesn't really rely that heavily on montage, but he does put it to good use in these two movies.
Right.
It's a
And that's
nice way
a
to
good point.
cover a lot of time and advance the story. I'm sorry, Hal. I don't want to get too far away from the Kuleshov effect, because Jim, when you told me what you're going to be talking about, I was hoping you'd bring this up, because it's a fascinating study. I've seen the original film of this, and it's just a really neat experimental piece of, for example, he took a shot of a man with a very neutral face and transposed it and followed that with a shot of a coffin, and asked people, well, what's the man feeling? Well, man's feeling sad. And then they took the exact same shot of that man and followed it with a picture of a shot of a sandwich. What's the man feeling? The man's feeling happy. And you can guide and manipulate the audience emotions by the guy doesn't change expression. It's the same neutral expression, but I don't know what I'm trying to say. You read into his neutral expression what you think he's feeling by what the images are around him. And it's a fascinating study that actually I've tried to apply in my own comics work. I find it's really interesting. The most interesting comics that I enjoy myself and that I try to make for myself are when the words and pictures are doing two different things. It's kind of a Kuleshov effect in combining graphics and text. If the words and pictures are doing two different things, then the audience has to sit there and say, those things don't obviously go together. Clearly, there's something deeper or more meaningful going on here. I've got to figure it out. And then they start knitting together this meaning, and then they become a co-conspirator in the telling of the story. And it's really powerful, a really powerful storytelling tool when it happens right. So I find the Kuleshov effect, folks, please look that up and try to find that original 100-year-old film. It's great stuff.
Yeah, and there's really continuing on with film school, there's three basic elements that allow us to understand movies. The Kuleshov effect is one that we can put a series of images and let the audience use their brains to decide what the story that's being told by this sequence of images. The primary one is persistence of vision, which was discovered by Roget, the guy that wrote the thesaurus. The persistence of vision is an idea that after you show something and take it off the screen, your eye still remembers what that image was. So as we're showing one image after another, the film would otherwise flicker if our brain didn't do that, have that persistence of vision. The third idea is something called the five phenomena, which is if you have, let's say you have three blinking lights, they're arrayed left to right. So the left light turns on, then the middle light turns on and the left light turns off, and then the right light turns on and the middle light turns off. Now, the lights have nothing in common with each other. They're just switches on an electrical circuit. But your brain says, well, the light moved from the left to the middle to the right. Mm-hmm. And it didn't, but your brain thought it did. So that allows you to take different moving shadows on a wall and say, oh, they're moving back and forth. And actually, they're not moving. The frames themselves are separate images. But your brain takes that five phenomenon and says, oh, it's a person and it's moving across the screen. And maybe it's training for a boxing match. So,
you know, what's sort of blowing my mind a little bit about this, but two things. First of all, I didn't know, I've come across the name Roget in Persistence of Vision. I didn't know it was the thesaurus Roget.
Yeah, same guy.
That's just, I mean, it's how fascinating to be famous for such, or, you know, known. Yeah. And it made a mark with two such totally disparate things in so many ways. But, you know, the idea of, when you laid out the three pillars there, that idea of persistence of vision in what we think of as that literal sense of, you know, here's a motion picture, and at least in the early days, we're showing 24 pictures a second, and your brain stitches it together, like you said, and it's interpolating the in-betweens and saying that that's smooth motion. But then with the Kuleshov effect that both you guys were talking about, for me, it's almost like a persistence of emotional vision, in the sense that, you know, okay, you show this guy's face, then we show the coffin, he's clearly sad, same face, is a sandwich, he's happy. These things, your brain is still doing that same task, but instead of at the, you know, at the millisecond level of translating flickering images into smooth motion, you're translating shifts from one concept or image or idea to the next and saying, this is how those things fit together.
Very much so.
Amazing how those things sort of dovetail and how there's a structural similarity to what our brains are doing there.
And so much of our brains are devoted to visual understanding. For example, if you take your hands, I'm showing this on video, so you can't see. If you take your hands and make like a basket of your hands, like you're leaning back in a, you know, you're about to go sunbathing, and you put your hands behind your head so that your fingers are touching the back of your skull, and you lean back. From the length of your fingers, that rectangle that your fingers are outlining, that's your visual cortex. That's how much of your brain is just devoted to interpreting the visual clues that are coming to your mind. So you have a very sophisticated visual processor in your head. And people like Roget and Kuleshov and Eisenstein found out how to tap into that huge machine, you know, that computer that's in the back of your head, that graphics processor that's in the back of your head. And it's amazing how it took until the 19th or 20th century to figure out how all that worked.
Yeah. Oh, you needed a reason, I think, to,
yeah,
you know, for it to work, and you needed to be some something behind it. What was coming to my mind as we talk about montages and think about your favorites and what a nice useful tool it is, and how, as you were saying, it's been sort of lampooned. It's almost a cliche in that, you know, even your average moviegoer maybe knows nothing about filmmaking, but even they might know the term montage. It's like, oh, here's the montage. You know, it's so ingrained and so accepted. But you think back to some of the earliest sort of commercial motion pictures. I said, well, here's a successful play. Let's get a camera in there and let's record what the actors do on stage. And then we can play that anywhere. You know, at that point, we we didn't yet have tools that were maybe unique to motion pictures things. So I was trying to think, is there a, and certainly Brian, you're talking about comics and things, we see, we do see similar, you know, similar techniques there. Are there other like pre-motion picture analogs? Would there have been a play? Would we be in a theater with live actors and see something that we would sort of equate to a modern montage in the days before film?
It occurs to me, if you think about something like the Bayeux Tapestry or something like that, it's a piece of fabric that tells the whole story of, you know, the battle and the conquest. It doesn't have panels. It doesn't divide it at a time. It sort of tells a long story over a long period of time in one piece of art. And maybe something like that.
That's a fantastic example.
There were also the
cave paintings, you know.
Yeah, Lascaux and things.
After the Civil War, there were Civil War panoramas that would travel, or actually would be built, and people would come and visit, like the Hippodrome in New York, and they would tell like the Battle of Antietam or the Battle of Gettysburg, and basically they'd unroll this a tapestry, much like the Bayeux Tapestry. They'd unroll it so you could see different actions going on in it. You know, day one and day two, Pickett's Charge, that kind of stuff. But, you know, and we've had before the motion picture, we've had, of course, things like the zoetrope and, you know, people like Edward Muybridge, who was trying to figure out whether horses' four hoofs ever left the ground at a gallop, accidentally building a machine that could take motion pictures that were, you know, they weren't shown in a motion at the time. They were just printed on paper. But, you know, being able to do that and see that's how motion worked, and then that whole idea that from these little pieces, you don't have to do everything. I mean, you just have to leave enough for your brain to do the rest of the work. Brian, I'm sure you're familiar with Scott McCloud's work, like understanding comics. And one of the takeaways that I had from Scott McCloud's book, because Scott McCloud's a cartoonist, he's also a comics theorist, I think is the best way to describe him. His idea is that you don't have to put in every single detail. You can draw a stick figure with a smiley face, and that's enough to convey an emotion because your brain will fill in those gaps. I mean, if you look at, you know, like Charles Schulz, if you look at his characters, they're all very simplified characters, but you get the whole meaning, all the emotions just from a couple of squiggles on paper.
Well, you've just appropriated about 40% of my standard lecture.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. But,
no, your Peanuts analogy is apt, and it's my favorite example. I'll put up a slide on the wall behind me of a close-up of the face of Charlie Brown. And the face of Charlie Brown is two dots for his eyes, half a circle for his nose, a squiggly line for his mouth. And with those four black marks on a piece of paper, first of all, our brains interpret that as a human face, which is remarkable and amazing in itself. But Charles Schulz's skill was such that not only do we recognize it as face, but we empathize with it as a character. And when Charlie Brown, you know, doesn't get a Valentine on Valentine's Day, or nobody wants to sit on the bench and eat lunch with him, Charlie Brown can break your heart. And it's amazing that can happen with basically four squealy ink lines on a piece of paper. That's the power of comics. McCloud talks about that a lot of when information is missing, our brain tends to fill it in. And that's a very powerful mechanism that can be used for good or ill.
Indeed.
Wow.
It can mislead us too. You know, we're pattern recognition machines. And, you know, anybody who's seen an optical illusion knows how easy it is to fool your pattern recognizers. But it's how we evolved, how we live. It's what makes us great, I think. I think that's our great gift. What sets us apart from the animal kingdom is that pattern recognition and interpretation.
My only sadness about this particular minute is I wish we could have more Howling Commandos. I wish they weren't reduced to a montage. I could watch three movies about about the Howling Commandos. There's so much going on.
It is the first time we get to see them working with Cap, and the next minute is more Howling Commando heavy. But I wanted to note that this minute is the first time we really see Captain America in costume, in his full Captain America uniform with the shield painted, and I as a comics fan, maybe this is a little controversial. I think this is a great interpretation of that of his costume. You know, the one we saw in the USO show is a almost literal interpretation of his comic book costume, and you can Right. see how ridiculous he looks in that thing. Pointedly so, that would not work for this movie. But I think this costume he's wearing into battle, this uniform, is a terrific kind of real world interpretation of what Captain America might wear in World War II. And I particularly have taken. It was taken the first time I saw him of the idea that the red stripes across his torso are basically a parachute harness. And I thought that was just lovely. I really enjoyed that.
And the mix of, you know, it's like fiberglass underneath cloth. And there's also some like denim, I think, in the midst of it all.
Yeah.
And so it's like it's all workable 1940s clothing that you could.
It's kind of poofy and quilted. It looks like something somebody would wear.
Yeah, it's
and the colors are a little bit subdued. We talk so much about color palettes and things, and there, he may be the brightest and most vivid thing in the room or in the scene, but it's still, you know, it's not the neon red, white, and blue of the disparagingly the showgirl outfit from earlier, the USO outfit or anything. It's still, you still buy that somebody might wear this. Now the shield is. Maybe a little over the top, but he puts it to such great use, we don't care.
He also has the wings are, you know, like the comic book wings on the helmet, but they're not, at least they're not like sticking out like the FTD, you know, Mercury. So it is workable with still being not, you know, a teeny bit flamboyant, but not too bad.
Right.
I do wonder about the chin strap, though. I guess, though, it's like a helmet, so it's fine. I don't think.
Yeah, they want it to look like a helmet. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing I just wanted to note in this minute, the other note I have is Captain America shoots to kill in this movie. We see him pull out his pistol, and he's firing away at folks. And I think we've touched on this before, but this is a different moral code than you see with other superheroes like Superman or Batman, who will not kill. Unless, you know, it's just the most desperate situation. Captain America's a soldier, and he's fighting World War II, and he's out there to kill some Nazis and some Hydra, and he's not, you know, he's leading the charge.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, we only get a brief glimpse of it here, but what's Bucky wearing? I can't figure that. I've scrubbed through this several times, and it looks like he has his own uniform. I'm not sure. It's some variation of a dulled down Captain America. I mean, he doesn't have the red and white stripes, but he has some kind of like an insignia on his shoulder, and it doesn't look like an army uniform. He's got like this popped up collar.
He's got the popped up collar. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
I hadn't noticed that, but maybe we'll get a better look at it in a future minute.
Yeah, it's just like I keep thinking that we're missing the scene where Bucky says, "Well, if you're gonna look cool, I want to look cool too."
Who's your tailor?
Yeah.
You know, hey, Stark, does that come in black?
Yeah. Wow. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about with the Howling Commanders, but let's hold that off for the next episode. Well, this has been a really deep down discussion about film theory and comic theory. And, well, if you know, hopefully it'll help somebody get their degree.
You finally put that education to use, Jim.
Yes, thank you. All these years, I finally found a place to put it. Well, anyway, thanks for joining us. If you would like to continue this conversation about all topics, film, comics, or otherwise, and also if you want to talk about this movie, which we should be doing, but we would like to hear from you. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.